Welcome to the Radio Readers Book Club's 2016 Spring Read Finale Live event. I'm Lynn Boitano, and I'm so happy to have you with us this afternoon. The HPPR Radio Readers Book Club is an online, on-air community of readers exploring themes of common interest to those who live and work on the High Plains. This season, we are exploring a sense of place with three books: Kent Harriff's Plain Song, S.C. Gwynn's Empire of the Summer Moon, and Gail Caldwell's A Strong West Wind. Today, we continue the exploration of a sense of place through literature with a panel of radio readers, including our book discussion leaders, BookBite feature contributors, with online reader voices as well. Before we get into our discussion, I'd like to take just a moment to thank two major funders, Lon Fromm of Colby, Kansas, and the Kansas Humanities Council. Both Lon and KHC share a commitment to supporting community-based cultural programs and encourages each of us to engage in the civic and cultural life of our community. Our first discussion is going to be about a sense of place in literature. If you're interested in exploring the online materials as you listen today, visit hppr.org and click on the Radio Readers logo. We now join the book discussion already in progress. Here's Jonathan Baker.
Into, Amarillo, where it's like, restaurants and strip malls, and it feels more of a human scale. But once you get out into the plains, it's staggering, and you feel the weight of the sky on you in the way that you feel the weight of the skyscrapers on you in New York City. And so I think that I was drawn to cities for that reason, because there was some some way for me to feel at home there. But for me, on the plains, I always felt seen or looked at because the population is low and it's so flat. But in New York City, I got to have experience that same feeling of the sublime or of being crushed, but not but I could feel anonymous there, which was comforting to me.
I think the urban in that novel, Plain Song, acts as kind of a foil as well, right?
Yeah,
it helps
I
to define the community of Holt and the sense of the plains, to define it against this urban space. Part of sense of place in literature is, I think, learning to appreciate the landscape through language, which is challenging for a writer. And it seems to me Plain Song has this sense of, it's very sparse, very minimal prose that to me gives a feeling of the expanse, but also the openness of the plains. It works for me.
I think you could say that if Holt is the protagonist, then Denver is almost the antagonist in a way, or exists, like you said. Yeah, and I think it's important that when I forget her name, but when she goes off to Denver, she lives in a high rise. She lives Victoria Rubido, right? She lives up in a, and she goes out onto that balcony and things. And this is something that she would not obviously be able to experience and hold.
And it's even more isolated, it seems, than she was in the small town on the isolated plains.
Right. Yeah, that's an important point, too.
Yeah.
I found it very touching, too, with the little boys, that 9 and 10 years old, and their family is tearing apart. And, of course, they're taken to Denver to visit their mother in that urban space. But when things are really disintegrating for them, they saddle up their horses and they ride out to visit the McFerrin brothers, who represent, it seems to me, something like the Old West in a sense. I mean, they're these old bachelor cowboys that work cattle, and their lives, their partnership, and the way they work together seems to represent a sense of stability and order to those boys that they're compelled toward.
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, it seems to be in Plain Song, we have that classic dichotomy that you see often in American literature, especially regional literature, country good, city bad. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to what extent that's legitimate. There's a sense that there's just no real community for Victoria or the boys when they're in Denver. and community happens in the small town life with the McFerrins and with the other people of town. I mean, does that seem valid or just something we want to believe that's true? You know, that community and neighbors happen in small towns, not in cities.
I think that that Kent Hariff is definitely participating in a myth here a little bit of the West. It's a myth we derive a lot of joy from. I'm not saying by myth I don't mean something that isn't true or can't be true. I mean that it's a story that we tell ourselves. But in the sense that the two old rancher brothers, they aren't, obviously they're old men, but they're not sexualized in any way. They don't seem to have any kind of libido. And this is the myth of the old cowboy. This is John Wayne and the Searchers. This is John Wayne and the man who shot Liberty Valance. These guys, they make you feel safe, you know. And then when Victoria goes off to Denver, she has the opposite experience, you know. Everything feels sexualized and threatening.
I'll disagree with you a bit because I think Hariff is breaking down stereotypes, because this small town, which should have the wholesome family values, and you look at what's going on and the high school guys using that young woman in the one scene, and then that's what they see, the little boys see as their introduction, their initiation to sex. They say, you see the way Victoria's just thrown out, used and thrown out, and not taken care of by her mother. I mean, this is a different small town.
That's a good point. And I think maybe he's lamenting the sort of death of that older myth in a newer time.
Or he's telling it like it really is.
This is Lynn, and I've got a comment from a radio reader in Hayes. This is from Helen, and she comments on what you're talking about. She says, I think Hariff shows that there's misbehaving, anger, and sin among folks in small towns. There are many families like the Waltons, so maybe that's not off base. But I think he did want to show that small towns do have their problems, too.
And so do we want to talk about some of the problems of small towns, either that Hariff identifies or that he redeems a small town in some way?
Well, I think he does participate in that myth of, you know, demonizing the big city and romanticizing the small town to a degree. But you're right. I mean, he shows the ugly side of the small town as well. And I think ultimately he gets away with it just by writing such a beautiful book. And and what redeems it in the end is the way, you're absolutely right, Denise, about the way that the community comes together in unconventional ways, unconventional families, unconventional relationships, that the people draw together in unexpected ways. And there's something very beautiful about the way that comes together at the end.
Yeah, well, the many families at the beginning of the book are fragmented or disintegrating. It seems to be the point is the way these characters and perhaps we ourselves form new alliances, make families that meet our needs.
And the family is the point of the book. The family is also related to the small town itself, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
These sort of Great Plains towns that are struggling to remain viable. And in order to survive, they have to form new strategies, which is what's happening on the family level as well.
I guess I feel like I want to mention Bonnie Jo Campbell's books about rural Michigan. And even though it's a very different geography, she really looks at the underbelly and the drug epidemics and other serious issues that all communities are facing, but are particularly maybe magnified in a small, isolated community like Holt.
I think that's an excellent point. And I've wondered, since that's Bonnie Jo Campbell's writing about small towns in Michigan, for instance, right, why is... not why, but how is Holt uniquely High Plains? Is Hariff onto something unique here, or is it just the same story set in a particular terrain?
I think there are times when people come together in these towns And there's also the seamier side of closing ranks to hide the truth, particularly where addiction is concerned, because out where many of us live in the panhandle of Texas, the methamphetamine shops are all in the small towns. They supply the cities, of course, but nobody wants to admit that that ugly thing is going on. Likewise, alcoholism is just rampant out on these isolated places, and there's always the old saw that they drank simply because there wasn't anything else to do. Mm-hmm. Well, that's fine and good, but at the same time, addiction is addiction. And it's been my experience to see that closing of ranks and not admitting that in any public way, because we're, you know, in the rural parts, more isolated parts, we don't do things the way they do in the cities, because that's where the bad stuff happens. Out in the isolated places, there's more sugarcoating going on.
I think
that's
a very obvious difference here is the sheer, like I mentioned earlier, the sheer visibility of people on the high plains. If a small town in New England or upper Michigan, say, where it's surrounded by hills and forests, there are places for people to hide and to hide their sins. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to hide your sins on the high plains.
Well, and I was going to speak to that earlier, is out where we live, it's very clear where the city ends and the plains begin. You go to a place like Dallas and the burbs go on forever and ever and ever. You're never out of there. Around Amarillo, when you get west, you're out in the plains again.
Yeah.
Same way with even the larger towns up here in Kansas, Dodge and Garden City. They end. You can see is mercury vapor lights and elevators. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot, even though it's flat, and that's an old saw too, that it's not really as flat as you think. There are places to hide, and they do quite well.
So is one of the distinctive features of where we live just the distance between communities?
Well, there's distance, but there's also this odd visibility. My husband, who comes from northern Wisconsin, was surprised. You drive these expanses, you look at a house, you see what the clothes are on the clothesline. You see how many garage doors there are. You can do a pretty quick numbers crunch and see exactly who lives there, what they're doing, how much they're worth, how well their farm's doing or not doing. And there's this openness that it is that in the community you are naked, you know, in many ways.
There's also a different mindset, I think, in terms of space and time out here. Because we don't talk in terms of how many miles it is to some place. We talk about how long it takes to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
You know, it's not 100 miles to such and such place. It's an hour and a half.
That's funny you say how much they're worth, though, because I disagree a little bit on that. I'm writing a novel, for example, about Nazareth, Texas right now. And you drive out there, and there are these small McMansions, these little, neat, well-appointed homes, and millionaires live in those homes, you know? But that's West Texas. You wouldn't build a gold-plated mansion. You know, Donald Trump wouldn't be welcome here.
But because of the landscape, it's visible. You know what they're doing.
Sure.
And you see a house starting to get a little ramshackle, and you know what's going on.
People are always aware of what their house looks like, you know, because it can be seen for miles.
We need to wrap up this part of the discussion about Plain Song and move to the next part. But I think this has been a fascinating conversation and it's really clarified for me, and I hope for you too, the distinctive qualities of where we live.
Thank you, panel. If you've just joined us, you're listening to High Plains Public Radio Readers Book Club 2016 Spring Read Live Event. We're discussing A Sense of Place on the High Plains. I'd like to introduce Eric McHenry. He's the Kansas State Poet Laureate joining us from Topeka today. Eric is chosen to share the work of late William Stafford, a fellow Kansan by birth and former poet laureate.
Somebody once asked the poet William Stafford why he kept writing about western Kansas, where he'd grown up, even after decades of living in Oregon. What was wrong with Oregon? Oregon's all right, Stafford said, except the mountains and the trees get in the way of the scenery. For Stafford, the ideal landscape was mostly skyscape. He liked an unobstructed view, prospects limited only by the distant curving away of the earth. The purpose of land isn't to be seen, it's to be felt with your souls. His poem, One Home, begins with the line, "Mine was a Midwest home. You can keep your world." And ends with, "Wherever we looked, the land would hold us up. The word hold appears again and again in Stafford's poetry. It's a versatile verb, and when he was writing about the Kansas of his childhood, it seemed to come to him unbidden. In The Rescued Year, his great long poem about growing up against the western boundary of Kansas, he uses it four times in four different senses: to behold, like an eye, and to contain, to make still, and to cling to, like a closed hand. When it's the land doing the holding in his poetry, the hand is always open. The land would hold us up. Stafford's western Kansas is an upturned palm. Listen for the word in this short lyric, "One Evening." On a frozen pond a mile north of Liberal, almost 60 years ago, I skated wild circles while a strange, pale sun went down. A scattering of dry brown reeds cluttered the ice at one end of the pond, and a fitful breeze ghosted little surface eddies of snow. No house was in sight, no tree, only the arched wide surface of the earth holding the pond and me under the sky. I would go home, confront all my years, the tangled events to come, and never know more than I did that evening, waving my arms in the lemon-colored light. Stafford's most memorable use of hold may have come not in a poem, but in a prose passage from his essay collection, You Must Revise Your Life. He recalled a day and night he spent as a teenager alone on a bluff above the Cimarron River, an ecstatic moment of self-realization. In the middle of the night, I woke and saw a long, lighted passenger train slowly pulling across the far horizon. No sound, steady stars. The morning was dim, sure, an imperceptible brightening of the sky with yellow, gray, orange, and then the powerful sun. That encounter with the size and serenity of the earth and its neighbors in the sky has never left me. The earth was my home. I would never feel lost while it held me. The earth, not western Kansas, was William Stafford's home. But western Kansas was where he felt most at home, because it was where he felt most on earth.
That was Eric McHenry, Poet Laureate of Kansas, reading the work of William Stafford. Thank you, Eric. Kent Harif, author of our first book in the series, has his 1999 award-winning novel about small-town life on the high plains by defining plain song as any simple, unadorned melody or air. Here's an example of a plain song.
Each day I'll be, each day I'll be, a golden deed,
a golden deed,
by helping them.
No sad song.
that was an Amish hymn, Each Day I'll Do a Golden Deed, sung by the Amish Singers. I'm Lynn Boitano. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. We continue our Radio Readers Book Club live event with our panel discussion.
Hi, this is Alex. We were just speaking a moment ago about what gives a region a particular distinctive sense of place. I was thinking about my own background. I've been fortunate to live in some magnificent places with sublime landscapes, Alaska, Washington State, Oregon, Colorado. And so when I moved to the Llano Estacado, the High Plains of Texas, it took a while to begin to appreciate the place. And in part, you know, it's a matter of physical geography on the one hand, climate, elevation, topography, aridity, light and space, and then also the cultural geography, the culture, the lifestyles, the economics of the region. One thing that struck me, though, was having to readjust the sense of scale. On the one hand, this massive open landscape that just dominates you, overshadows you, makes you feel insignificant almost. But on another level, someone once told me that what makes the plains is, of course, a function of mostly aridity. And the reason there aren't trees is there is not enough rainfall. And so a way to think of the grasslands is of a very small forest. And when you begin to think in those terms, the landscape sort of shifts for you, and suddenly you're not a small insignificant speck on this huge landscape, but you're suddenly a giant towering over a forest. Anyway, I think that the books that we've been talking about, one thing they certainly have in common is this powerful sense of landscape.
I think Harrop has that in his language, where you slow down to be in the plains, and he slows down. You watch things more carefully. You're observant. And I think a lot of his scenes are understated, where you must participate to fill in the blanks of what he's explaining by not being an extravagant writer.
His language is lovely. I think there are passages, you know, that I like to go back to and just savor. The minimalist style that he uses, I think, is really appropriate for our landscape. I was really thinking about what Alex was saying, too, about it being a matter of scale, I think, and perspective. I remember inviting friends from college home with me to see my home state of Kansas, and this one particular person who was from Connecticut, which is to me a very compressed state. Don't have anything wrong, you know, I don't have anything against Connecticut particularly, but when he came to Kansas, he was just, I could tell he was uncomfortable when we got out there in central Kansas of the car, and he looked around and he goes, "My God," he said, "there's no place to hide." Which speaks to that idea of visibility from the earlier component as well.
Well, I think that shows up in the prose as well. Kent Harrop is a magnificent prose stylist, but you wouldn't really think it if you just read a sentence or two. It's more beauty by accretion, you know, because
plain
of
style.
Because of its simplicity. I mean, there's a reason I think that the book is called Plain Song, you know. This is a simple style of prose about a simple place in its way. It's complicated in other ways, but these are simple people, and there's nowhere for purple prose to hide either. There's nowhere for frippery or extravagances, you know, to hide in this prose, you know, and that echoes the landscape.
It's a land of plain spoken people, and I think there are some who think simple somehow means unsophisticated, and the sophistication is on a completely different level. And these plain-spoken people out here really usually take the approach that if you know, you take us or leave us, and if you leave us, that's okay with me. That's just fine. And Jonathan spoke earlier about the sky feeling like it can crush you. I've been lived out here on the Llano long enough to where when I do go back to cities and I'm around too many trees, I literally get claustrophobic, and I half jokingly say it's because I can't see the Comanches coming.
Yeah.
So there is some of that. I mean, I did claustrophobic like your friend from Connecticut. Mm-hmm. There's no place for me to hide in a city. Mm-hmm. Not in the way I've come to learn to hide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Indeed, and I think that because there is this kind of interplay between the rich inner life, that with this scale, you've got to contend with being a teeny little mammal squeaking around on the surface of the earth, in the magnificence of the clouds, the Milky Way at night, the stars at night. The moon is a person. I mean, it is so alive in this landscape that you constantly have to reevaluate and regauge who you are in that scale.
This is Lynn. I've got a comment from Mickey from Hayes that kind of made me think about that. She's contrasting the bigness of the landscape and with the tininess of the conversation, I guess. She says, she's talking about the McFerrin brothers, mm-hmm. and how they don't have a largeness of vocabulary or a largeness of things to talk about. She says, my favorite characters were the McFerrin brothers. I love the way they converse with each other. I could really picture them in my mind sitting in the parlor, in their truck, in the cafe. I chuckled in the way they were trying to develop a relationship with Victoria because, quote, what did two bachelors know about talking to women, let alone a teenager? I liked the way they had to use their knowledge of pregnant cows to talk to a pregnant teenager.
Yeah, I think those guys are the jewels of the book. The interesting thing about them to me is that they feel like genre characters to me in a way. They don't feel totally real. I mean, there are these old guys in the donut stop in West Texas at 7 a.m. and we've all seen them, and that's who reminds us of these guys. But the reason those guys are mythologized is, you know, that we love to think about these, like, the quiet, noble man, and they felt to me, the cowboy, rancher guy, and they felt to me like they had stepped out of a genre novel into a literary novel, a little bit, which isn't to say that I don't love them because they're my favorite characters in the book, but I'm not sure that they feel totally like, they feel still feel like part of a fictional universe to me. Am I wrong?
I will not pass judgment on your taste. But I will say they remind me of my grandfather, who spoke slowly and seldom, but everyone listened when he spoke.
Yeah.
The words meant something. There wasn't chatter, but when he had something to say, there was a hush in the family, and we listened.
But I think you said it, Jonathan, in a way. I mean, that's precisely what those characters are. They are genre characters stepping into a literary fiction, but that's what's happening to them as well, because they're moving out of their very static existence as the brothers into this messy world of a pregnant teenage girl. So,
but they still act nobly in every. I shouldn't say nobly. I feel like they're almost sinless, these guys, and they're adorable.
I think there's some hard moral dilemmas, and we see people without morality, and we see people not doing the right thing, and so when someone they step up to do the right thing, they suddenly are put in that hero role that is part of the Western melodrama. Even
I think they're figured as saints. Minor saints at some point.
The reason that these guys are so interesting is because they're going against their masculine Western nature, and they're being forced to be nurturing. And that is the tension in every one of their scenes that keeps us reading, right? It's like these guys are nurturing towards cattle and towards the land, but they're not used to.
I'm going to interrupt you on that one. I mean, I don't know that they're nurturing to cattle. I think they're very realistic in their approach to their raising of cattle for stock and market. they're pretty matter of fact. There are a couple of scenes early in the novel, for instance, when Tom goes to help the McFerrin brothers, and I think those are scenes where we see the McFerrin brothers more realistically, if you will, less saint-like, telling earthy stories about sexual relationships between men and women in town, and some, I think, some pretty well, I'll just say it again, real language. Mm-hmm. So that's not to say that the McFerrin brothers aren't idealized, but like others have said on the panel, when I read the novel for the first time, being much younger than I am now, I recognize the McFerrin brothers as being very similar to older men in my hometown and very much like my father. And so they do take the pregnant teenager in. I wouldn't go so far as to say they nurture her. They take care of her. They give her a place to live.
Right. What I was saying is there's that tension between someone who needs nurturing and these two old guys to whom it does not come naturally, and that's the tension in those scenes. But maybe if I'm wrong about that, then why are they so compelling? If as a writer, I would say that conflict obviously is the thing that drives a narrative, and those scenes with those brothers are so compelling, which means there must be some conflict happening there. What is that conflict, and why is it so compelling? Is what I'm asking.
I think in a way that for me the tension is between the old ways that the McFerrins represent and the new ways that Tom and his family represent. The McFerrins are very static, as you mentioned. They're very rooted in their place and in their relationship to each other. But Tom and his family don't have that. Everyone in that family is seeking something.
But you see the McFerrins' hearts start to open as the novel progresses.
Sure.
And I think that's the narrative arc, narrative arc.
Well, you know, I think with cowboys, at least from my own researches on them, generally speaking, they were careful in revealing themselves around anyone.
Yet
at the same time, they're the most tender-hearted people you would see. And I know it's fashionable to dismiss some of the old myths about cowboys, but it's been my experience. The older ones are always around a baby calf, for example, or a kitten or a baby. See a cowboy around a baby, and they're just tender-hearted. And I think they're all. This is my own feeling. They're hopeless romantics, absolutely, and many of them, in fact, were quite well read, and they loved the myths about those sorts of things, but they wouldn't talk about it. And, you know, they kept their words to themselves because their work required spare movement, no wasted anything, and wasted when you know talking was just a waste of time and waste of oxygen. You could use elsewhere. So I think we got to be careful about that.
I think that
and fairly structured lives too. I mean, when you're ranching or farming, you know, you have to do the same things at the same time, day after day. I guess.
I just was going to say, I think the tension is that they recognize that life has passed them by, and they argue about that between them. You know that you know you might blow this opportunity, but I want to take care of this girl or try to because we've never done that and we missed something in life. Yeah. And they scold each other too. And this is what makes them so compelling is that they have no language, right? And one of them is trying to relate to the girl, Victoria, by talking about a prolapsed heifer.
Right.
And the other one scolds him and says, you can't talk to her like that.
The grain market report, right?
But that is their language. It's not that they do not have language. That is their language, what they've spent their life doing. And they can. That's their set of metaphors.
Yeah. And their frame of reference, absolutely. That's what they know about birth.
And Victoria recognizes that. I mean, she's willing to learn that language.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure I agree with you, Michael, totally.
Good.
Because in your account there, it seemed like you were saying, oh, cowboys are affectionate sweethearts. They just choose.
No.
Okay.
It's not what I said.
You said, see, whenever they're around a baby, they just melt. But
warm, fuzzy people.
For me, that seems like you're saying they just choose not to be affectionate or not to be. Whereas my experience is that they, like we were saying, they don't have a language for it. They don't. And on the high plains, there's no place for any kind of outsized emotion, including love, you know, especially among men.
Well, there's a lot about just enduring the cold, enduring the wind, enduring the heat. And I think it's interesting that we are talking about the McFerrin brothers rather than Tom.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And he actually is the protagonist. He is the heir of the cowboy culture. And he's teaching history. He's got a messed up marriage. He's got two little boys. He's trying to raise as best he can, and he's trying to figure out what tools and how he can navigate. The opening scene: he's looking at the sunrise. He's smoking a cigarette, having a quiet moment. And in that moment, he is turning to the beauty of the land for his spirituality.
Yeah. He is the new generation. He's an interesting counterpoint, too.
He really is, because while he's admiring the land, I mean, I think that's very telling the way you put that, Denise. He's admiring the land. It's scenic to him. And the McFerrins are on the land and in the land and of the land. And where is Tom's future as an admirer of the land?
Yeah.
Well, he's teaching history.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what do we see with these this Tom's sons? Where do they end up?
I think that's a question that gave us all pause. we'd mentioned in our earlier discussion that the boys do find strength and solace with the McFerrins, and they're willing to, ride a horse and get lost on their way there. But they do find the comfort there. So we're going to listen to Jonathan Baker next. Thank you.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to a live book discussion of the High Plains Public Radio Radio Readers Book Club. I'm Lynn Boitano. Jonathan Baker is an author who grew up in the Texas Panhandle. He recently returned after living in New York City and is now living in Canyon, Texas. And he asks some thought-provoking questions about the way we occupy the High Plains today as compared to the way the Comanches did for several hundred years.
I'm Jonathan Baker, a writer from Canyon, Texas, and I've been asked to talk a little about Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynn. I love this book because it paints such an unflinching picture of the staggering beauty and brutal reality of my homeland. The High Plains is perhaps the greatest grassland in the world. It's hopelessly wide and unnervingly flat, and until somewhat recently, it was uninhabitable. But with the introduction of the horse to the plains, something remarkable happened. The confluence of the Comanche, the horse, and these limitless grasslands led to the rise of one of the most powerful mounted forces the world has ever known. If you were to invent the ideal denizen of the High Plains, you couldn't do much better than the Comanche. Their very natures echoed this place in countless ways. I live on a high, flat part of the plains known as the Llano Estacado. These palisaded plains served as the center of the Comancheria for 2.5 centuries. This land feels somehow low and high at the same time. In all this flatness, I sometimes feel like the tallest thing for miles around. On a clear summer night, I feel like my hair might tickle the stars if I stand tall enough. The Llano can seem mundane or majestic, depending on the angle. The Comanche were like this, too. Most anyone who came across a Comanche brave without his mount, a rarity, would remark on the Indians' squattiness. They were unassuming, unremarkable. But once these warriors were mounted, they suddenly became imposing, imperial, and terrifying. Like Caprock prairie dogs, the Comanche could also be playful. They were known for their practical jokes and impish humor. By the opposite token, like a West Texas cloudburst, they could thunder down on you from above like the devil's unholy vengeance. In fact, the Comanche call to mind the weather of the plains in many ways. The wind blows harder on the Great Plains than anywhere in the continental U.S. You could be enjoying the breeze on a delicate spring day when suddenly a norther might blow in, faster than any man could hope to run, bringing with it lightning and terror. In his book, Gwynn writes of the Comanche, their striking range was 400 miles. That meant that a Spanish settler in San Antonio was in grave and immediate danger of a Comanche brave sitting before a fire in the equivalent of modern-day Oklahoma City. They were that fast. And just like a panhandle rainstorm, they could vanish into the flatlands like phantoms. That's why the Comanche remained unbeatable for so long, because they so perfectly inhabited this place. In fact, it was only after the Texas Rangers adapted Comanche methods, attacking from horseback, that they were able to rebuff the natives' advances. The Comanche, of course, were eventually defeated. But what Gwynn's book makes me wonder is, have we, as Westerners of the 21st century, ever been able to inhabit this place in the way that the Comanche did? I think the answer is a fairly obvious no, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. As people of the plains, are we meeting this place on its own terms? Do we take more than we give? Do our businesses, our architecture, our attitudes promote the sense of openness and possibility that the Great Plains inspire? Or are we living apart from this place? Have we succumbed to our own complacency? What I mean to ask is, are we adapting ourselves to meet the needs of this great open land? Or are we forcing our will onto the plains, as we did the Comanche? Just something to think about as we discuss S.C. Gwynn's riveting chronicle of these true High Plains people.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You pose some interesting and insightful questions that challenge us to think about the native inhabitants of these High Plains. Let's listen to a short Smithsonian recording, Folkways recording, of a Comanche song. Recordings of a Comanche song collected by Laura Bolton for Smithsonian Folkways. If you'd like to know more about this kind of music, all you need to do is to go online to hppr.org, look for the Radio Readers Book Club tab, and you'll find more in the book discussion guide. The full title of S.C. Gwynn's book is Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the most powerful Indian tribe in American history. Quanah Parker was the son of Comanche Chief Peta Nakona and Cynthia Ann Parker. She was an American, or rather an English American, who had been kidnapped at about the age of 9 and assimilated into the tribe. Quanah, a fierce warrior, later became the main spokesman and peacetime leader of the Native Americans in the region, a role he performed for more than 30 years. This next piece is performed by Parker's grandson, Baldwin, as part of a narrative featured at Panhandle Plains Historical Museum in Canyon, Texas.
Commercial hunters decimated the once vast herds of bison. The Southern Plains Indians came to realize that their way of life was being destroyed. What happened at the Adobe Walls Trading Post in 1874 changed forever the pattern of trade on the Panhandle Plains. That summer, a combined force of Comanche, Kiowa, and Southern Cheyenne warriors attempted to overrun the post and drive the hunters and traders from the plains. The Indian forces were not successful at Adobe Walls, but the battle prompted the United States government to launch a military campaign that came to be called the Red River War. Before attacking the trading post on that fateful day, June 27, 1874,
Quanah Parker, a Comanche leader of the raiding party, did what was customary for warriors when they were about to risk their lives in battle. He sang his medicine song. In the years to follow, his personal song came to commemorate the entire battle, and it is now called the Adobe Walls Song.
Yo, yo, hi, day, yo, hi, day, day. Yo, yo, hi, day, yo, hi, day, day. Yo, yo.
During the 125th anniversary of the Red River War, Quanah Parker's grandson, Baldwin Parker Jr., traveled to the Adobe Walls battle site near the Canadian River in Hutchinson County to honor his grandfather by singing his song.
Yo, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day, day. Yo, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day, day. Yo, hey, day, day, yo. Yo, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day, day. Yo, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day, day.
Different cultures remember historic events in different ways. Baldwin Parker Jr. remembers in the Comanche way, through story and song.
Yo, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day, yo, yo, hey, day, yo, yo, hey, day, yo, hey, day.
Due to the events at Adobe Walls, U.S. Army forces drove the last remnants of Southern Plains Indians back onto reservations in Indian Territory. The Indian technologies, the fabric of their communities, their language and arts, were all replaced by those of the new people who moved into their homelands. A way of life born of centuries of adaptation to the plains environment came to an abrupt end.
That was the grandson of Quanah Parker performing Adobe Walls. You're listening to a special Radio Readers Book Club event on High Plains Public Radio. I'm Lynn Boitano. This is High Plains Public Radio, in touch with the world at home on the High Plains, KANZ Garden City 91.1, KTXP Bushland 91.5, KJJP Amarillo 105.7, KTOT Spearman Perryton 89.5, KGUY Guyman 91.3, KCSC Lamar 90.7, KZAN Hayes 91.7, KZNA Hill City 90.5, KZCK Colby 88.1, KZNK Brewster 91.1, and online at hppr.org. Support for this program is provided by Amarillo Grape and Olive, serving the High Plains with balsamic vinegar flavors, extra virgin and infused olive oils, and specialty spices. More at amarillograpeandolive.com, myspotify.com. I'm sorry, grapeandolive.myshopify.com. And also in part by Jeff Carruth, Pampa native and practicing attorney in Dallas, specializing in business organization, acquisitions and mergers, bankruptcy, and more. Information is at WKPZ.com. The book we've been exploring is Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynn, the second selection in the 2016 Spring Read. Jane Howarda of Dodge City, Kansas, is our discussion leader. Jane?
We are going to be talking about Empire of the Summer Moon. And Jonathan, I know you've posed us some very interesting questions we'd like to pursue. But Michael, I understand you know quite a bit about the two songs we've just heard. Would you mind teaching us about those?
The Adobe Walls song was, as you heard, sung by Quanah Parker's grandson, Baldwin. And it was sung on the occasion of the 1874 battle at Adobe Walls, which is in now Hutchinson County, Texas. It's actually within a mile of a battle also called the Battle of Adobe Walls, held 10 years earlier between Kiowas and Comanches, and involved Kit Carson, as a matter of fact. And they're all related to a former trading post brought there by the Bent brothers in the late 1840s, which was unsuccessful because it was in the middle of Comancheria, and they didn't want you out here, then you didn't come out here. So ultimately what happens after the Battle of Adobe Walls is unsuccessful because it was all based on the Indian warfare tactic of surprise or advantage. two more events actually happen close to where we are, and one is the what's called the German Massacre, precipitated on an immigrant family by the last name of German, attacked, and then two or three of the little German girls were kidnapped by Cheyennes. And then a surveying party in western Kansas was also annihilated, mainly taking out retribution for the lack of success at Adobe Walls. And, of course, this is all uses as springboard the Medicine Lodge Treaty of 1867 and then the Ouachita Massacre that Custer held out on southern Cheyennes, who'd also been at Sand Creek. So it's a series of events that lead to, ultimately, the Red River War. It really, to me, it signals the end of Comancheria, because everything starts to slide after that. They go from 40,000 people in the mid-19th century to, by the end of the Red River War, there are 1,500 of them left. 1,500. So,
I don't know how the others of you feel, but that's something I felt when I was reading this particular book, is that it just seemed that these two cultures, the white culture as Gwen describes it, and the Comanche, aren't going to be able to live together on this land. Their values, their worldview are just too different.
Well, I need to speak to the other piece of music as well, if you'll indulge me. It's a song at San Ildefonso Pueblo, and it's called the Comanche Song. All the pueblos along the Rio Grande in New Mexico all have Comanche songs and ceremonies not necessarily celebrate when the Comanches came to visit their villages, because their visits were not terribly friendly, right, unless they wanted them to be. And they all hold festivals and dances and special ceremonies related to that, because prior to white contact, Comanches didn't let anybody come out here. It didn't matter where you came from, because, of course, Comanche is they use their own name for their own people, as the people or the human beings. And, of course, Comanche is a Ute word that means people who fight with us all the time. And they didn't get along with anybody. And so I think it's important you recognize that Puebloan song as recognizing the hegemony that the Comanches enforced out here.
I might shift the point of view a little bit. I have Native heritage. It's Delaware. It's not Comanche. I can't speak for Comanche people. But I can speak to the continuing feelings against Native people that are part of the danger of being a Native person in the United States today. Native women have one of the highest rates of murder and abuse from outsiders of any other ethnicity. American Indian men are incarcerated at a higher rate than anyone else, that are killed by police, than, you know, really very awful statistics. And, you know, I think of my own grandfather living in the southern Kansas plains and his family being forced out of there by the Ku Klux Klan. So these feelings that you see in Empire of the Comanche Moon, that you have these terrible tortures that were horrendous. Torture is horrible, whichever way it goes, whether it's at Sand Creek, Ouachita, which were the inception, and these terrible mutilations and tortures and killings that were visited upon the Southern Plains people, also have an ongoing repercussion. And because this, you know, you go from 45,000 people to 1,500, there's a statistical fact there that indicates that we need to be very careful when we talk with each other, when we write about these human experiences of violence and aggression, and that it is part of human nature, and it isn't just one side or another. And I will just say one more thing. In this book, you see details of horrible mutilations, murders, torture, deaths. You do not see any of that from the whites that were visited upon the Native people. That's completely glossed over.
It's an excellent point, and I think that that in many ways the author misses the point that the things that he writes about in great length and great graphic detail are highly symbolical, I think, and I think it'd be safe to say that they're virtually a retaliation for things that were already practiced upon these peoples at Sand Creek, at Ouachita, at, you know, the list goes on and on. And their retaliation, and it actually goes back to the question that happens amongst historians quite a lot, is who started scalping in the first place?
Indeed.
And I think it's an excellent question, and I'm not sure we can find the answer, but it, you know, it's chicken or the egg kind of thing, but it's always in terms of retaliation and fear. And so these mutilations are highly symbolical, like the buffalo hunters that led up to the Adobe Walls battle, seeing the buffalo slaughter had begun, starving largely late teenage boys and men in their early 20s. They're starving. They left the reservation at Fort Sill, and they see their basically their supermarket laying on the ground, rotting, like that great scene in Dances with the Wolves, which was actually a Comanche story, by the way. And to see that, they were fearful, they were starving, they were desperate, and they were absolutely enraged. So their killings and mutilations were not so much to inflict, but to send a message.
Indeed. I do say that in this book, I do appreciate the description of the adeptness of the Comanche people. The mapping, I think that he does some wonderful research in the Texas Rangers and how they, the reverse assimilation in that they learned from the Comanches how to ride on horses and shoot from, you know, load and shoot from the horse. And it changed how that war went. And it was only until they entered into the land on its own terms, learned how to work with it, and learned to fight like the native people were teaching them, that they could have any kind of agency in that land. And, of course, the Comanches were fighting for their homeland. Mm-hmm. And would you not fight for the last, you know, you see your children attacked, you fight any tactic you can.
The adoption of guerrilla warfare tactics that, of course, were mastered by native groups all across North America really wasn't accepted amongst the armed forces in the U.S. They could not understand why they would not fight like Europeans and march toward each other in straight lines and shoot each other at convenient distances. And they were baffled by that. And so all those old Westerns you see, where I always say this, the Indians are always riding conveniently within rifle range, get shot off their horses. That's just nonsense. They didn't do that. And so the tactics of the Texas Rangers, and especially the advancements in technology and firearms, that was a key, and especially repeating firearms come into play, particularly in the Red River campaign. So,
and that took quite a while. Yeah, actually, the bow and arrow was the better weapon for buffalo hunting, for warfare. You could shoot quickly, what, a dozen arrows in a minute or two. Mm-hmm. I mean, native people, you know, they could shoot those things quickly and accurately at a full gallop.
And we talk about the status of the Comanches as the greatest horsemen. They absolutely were. I mean, and because of their trade network, and we've talked, in conversation leading up to this discussion, we talked about other sources, especially Pekka Himalainen's Comanche Empire. And he posits that Comanche Empire actually extended from the Rocky Mountains to the Mississippi Valley through their trade network and all the way up north into the Dakotas. They were trading with the Mandans for horses in the early 19th century. Now, you think about that. That's the entire middle of the United States that was controlled by Comanches.
Can we talk about this sense of place and how all this ties into that? And especially you were talking about the reverse assimilation that was necessary for the Texas Rangers to eventually defeat the Comanche, and they had to do that by, like, as you said, meeting the land on its own terms, meeting the Comanche on their own terms, because the Comanche lived so perfectly in this place, which meant that this is a place where they were not an agricultural tribe. I think that's important to say in the beginning, and that probably had a lot to do with the fact that they were able to defeat the Apache, because the Apache were in some ways agricultural sometimes, and also the Apache couldn't fight from horseback, which ultimately led, I think, to them being kicked off of the High Plains and the Comanche taking over there. But what is it about the Comanche, Michael, do you think that made them so perfect for this part of the country.
Or, if or, I may jump
I didn't mean to, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
What you see here is not the physical technology, but the soft technology. They had this ability to map, and there's a wonderful passage in here where it says, you know, everybody sits down and council maps things out, and without any error, they can go out and raid 350 miles away and not make a wrong turn.
Yeah.
So that interior understanding of the land and the tools they had to work with that, and also their endurance and their understanding of the land, that you can't, it's not tangible. So on the outside it looks like, oh, primitive, you know, oh, you know, low tech people who don't know what they're doing. Well, au contraire, they absolutely had skills that allowed them to be superb inhabitants of that landscape.
In a highly sophisticated society, mm-hmm. of different levels, and Hemelainen, for example, talks about being born Comanche and then becoming Comanche. There's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And they practiced a great deal of adoption,
right.
All the time. And those people also, there was a hierarchy within the Comanche community. And to me, they were natural stockmen. You know, they had horses that everyone coveted. Likewise, they were not necessarily herding buffalo, but they certainly were using that as a product. And one of the things that doesn't get mentioned a lot is the climate out here, the periodic droughts that we have. And in fact, there was a terrible drought in the years leading up to the Red River War in the mid-1870s. And the primary threat to Comanches at that time was starvation, not warfare, but starvation, because buffalo and the Comanche Mustang herds, according to Hemelainen, were competing for the same grass. And there's only a certain number of grasslands out here.
Mm.
And so that's part of it. It was a highly sophisticated society, hierarchical, and to say that they were somehow this primitive Stone Age society is just ridiculous.
You mentioned something I'd like to hop on, if I may. The adoptions within the Comanche were common, and to me that's one of the key ideas of the Quanah Parker story, is that his mother had been adopted from white settlers into the Comanche. Yet when she returns or is returned to her white family, she's not at all accepted in the same way. So when you talk about a sophisticated culture of the Comanches, I also think that maybe Gwynn underplays the humanity of the Comanche quite a bit when he doesn't really develop that concept so much of these adoptions. And what happens both when Cynthia is returned and Quanah, so to speak, returns as well to white culture is, I think, very troubling.
I think one of the issues in all the captivity narratives that one reads is the women have such a higher status.
Mm-hmm.
In the native culture at that time, 19th century, women couldn't inherit land. She couldn't, you know, like on and on. It's women's roles were very subordinated, legally, socially, culturally, in religious terms. Mm-hmm. Whereas this book kind of talks about, oh, the women had to work so hard. The women also had a lot of control and status. And that was hard to give up. A lot of these native captivity narratives, the women don't want to go back, or if given a choice, they will not go back.
Or like Cynthia Ann, they kept trying to escape and go back to Comancheria, mm-hmm. yeah. where they knew they really belonged, their spiritual place.
Yeah.
And also, I think there's some of the land comes into play there, too, because they'd become Llaneras, you know, people of the plains by that time. And I think that's important. Because downstate in Texas, where she came from, that's highly wooded, big timber country. And I think that plays a role in it. I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as far as Quanah is concerned, you know, he's a man of two worlds, literally. And we were talking about this at the break, about he's Quanah at a certain point, but then he becomes Quanah Parker. He has a last name, a Euro-American yeah. last name. Yeah. And I think he was a very savvy, highly intelligent person. Mm-hmm. He worked out grass leases with Texas cattlemen, for example. Anyway, he recognized that way of life was over, and he quickly switched gears. It was like flipping a switch. which is also one of the reasons why he's sort of a double-edged sword in the Comanche community now. Hmm. Is they're highly divided on which way they go.
Same like Geronimo, who when he came into Fort Sill and said, "Okay, this is the deal," he said, "Okay," you know, and he started going to church. He kept one wife. He started charging a fee to have his picture taken. He went to the fairs, mm-hmm. and you know, made money at the World Fairs. He was at Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration. He even wrote his own memoir. You know, as told to memoir. It's very interesting because he had a very strong business sense, and these were good business people. They understood what mm-hmm. was happening and what they needed to do to survive.
This is Lynn, and I've got a comment on that reminds me of that from a reader named Helen in Hayes, and she's talking about how she wasn't surprised that Quanah adapted so well to his new life after his life on the plains was over. She says he apparently was realistic about the fact that despite his best efforts, his previous life was no longer viable. And she says, "I don't see that as a treason." And I know some people do see it as a treason, but she says, "I don't see that as a treason against his earlier identity. It was just pragmatic. I think that most successful people in life are able to adapt to realities. That doesn't mean that they don't persevere at what's important, but they know when it's time to adapt."
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but there might even be three Quanahs, in the sense that there's Quanah Parker, there's Quanah, and then there's the young Quanah who was not well regarded or respected in the Comanche community and had to prove himself more than a full-blooded Comanche brave would have had to. And he did so in battle repeatedly. He was an incredibly fearless warrior. And so I think that first conversion to becoming a chief, from becoming a part white, not well respected member of the community, maybe prepared him for a later conversion in the sense of being able to put his foot back into the white world, as it were.
Well, I think it's an excellent point, because in spite of their proclivities for adoption, mixed blood kids weren't accepted initially, and they certainly had a hard time. And as Jonathan was speaking to that, even to the point where Peta Nakona switched bands. He was a Pinateca and went out to the Quahadis, who were the most considered the wildest and the ones who wanted to have the least to do with whites. Which they are also seem to be more welcoming because they were more free range than anything. And so I think it's a good point. And I think it is correct that there were three worlds. And many mixed blood kids, even today, they don't know where to be. They mm-hmm. don't know what their tribe really is.
Yeah.
And that's something that's part of our dialogue today.
Well, and I think it's been a fascinating dialogue. Appreciate all the input and the perspective on this story. We're going to move now to hearing some poetry.
I'm Lynn Boitano. You're listening to a special live event celebrating a sense of place through literature. We're talking about S.C. Gwynne's Empire of the Summer Moon. You'll find an in-depth information about the book and more at hppr.org. The book discussion guide features a selection on music past and present. Christian hymns brought by missionaries to the Comanches were translated. However, while the text carried meaning, the musical style was completely foreign. Eventually, Native Americans created original texts sung to original tunes that bore a, quote, genetic relationship to a more traditional style. Let's listen to Comanche hymn performed by the members of the Patarsi Church.
Jesus is all I'm in Maguizo, I toy. Jesus is all I'm in Maguizo, I toy. Bananzo Macarlo. Time in my queen, so I do it. Time in my queen, so I do it. Oko tomo batu. Time in my queen, so I do it. Burn out to
me my queen, so I do it. Die me my queen, so I do it. Oh, God, come over, do. Die me my queen, so I do.
Jesus is God, I me my queen, so I do it.
That was Comanche hymn by the members of the Patarsi Church,